When we last met, we were talking about Kant's theory of knowledge and how he gets around Hume. And I want to continue that. It's getting into the thick of things now, getting interesting here. One of the things that Kant points out, I have said, and this is to his credit, is that we experience space and time. But space and time are not perceptions in the Humean sense of an impression, because for him, a sense impression means colors, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds. And if that's what you mean, space and time don't have any of those properties. So for Hume, it's a huge problem that he can't solve. How are things spatial and temporal? When he deals with that in his own works, he says it's an idea that arises out of, say, three notes played in succession on a flute. I hear one, it's followed by the other, it's followed by, and that's followed by the next one. And that's what gives me the idea of time. But that doesn't fly, even on his own definitions and according to his own theory. Because according to his own theory, the only thing in our mind are colors, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds. And succession doesn't have any of them. The succession of three notes is not yellow or rough or really cold, and it doesn't taste like orange. It doesn't have any of the perceptual qualities, the sensory properties that Hume insists everything has to have to be in the mind as an impression. And the only ideas we have are copies of impressions, but succession isn't the copy of any impression. Same thing with spatial arrangement. We experience some things as in front of, behind, to the left of, above, and so on. But to the front of, behind, left, to the left of, and above have no color, no taste, no touch, no tactile sensation, no sound when you try to hit them, if you are foolish enough to try to hit them. Those don't belong in Hume's theory. You can't get them in. He's ruled them out by, there's nothing in the mind, not first in the senses. And to his credit, is going to reject that. It's not true that there's nothing in the mind, but first, not first in the senses. Not at all. Start with space and time. They certainly are the way our experiences are organized. There are modes, ways of organization. They represent kinds of putting things together, putting together properties into a certain shape. Maintaining an object exists through a certain period of time, and we can talk about before we made it and after we burned it in the fire. And before and after don't have any color, taste, or smell. See, they're not sensory. So Kant wants to allow for all of that. And he says a clue to it is the kind of judgments that we make when we talk about things. Judgments here means statements. And if you recall, I went over this before and I said there are many kinds of sentences, not all of which assert something that as true or false. But that's what characterizes a statement. A statement asserts that something is the case, and it is therefore either true or false, or partly true and partly false. That can count too, of course. But here are the types of judgments, that is, statements, that Kant notices we make. So the first category is quantity. We make statements about quantity that are universal, that means all P is Q, all crows are black, for example. Particular, this crow is black. Singular, it's about a single individual, such as George needs a haircut. We can look then at the quality, judgments, statements that assert certain qualities. And they can. He means the quality of the judgment. A judgment can be affirmative. Yes, that's so. Negative, no, it's not, or infinite. I find that a strange contrast, and An infinite judgment, I don't get. I don't think it fits. But we'll go to the next category, relation. Categorical, hypothetical, disjunctive. These are kinds of statements in logic. A categorical proposition just asserts P is Q. A hypothetical says if P, then Q. That's the hypothetical here, the if, then. And he says there are disjunctive statements, P or Q. This is the symbol for or in logic. I'll just write it out in English. They are P or Q. Here are relational statements. How are things related? Well, if this, then that, or this or that, maybe both. We use the weak sense of or there. Or means the weak sense, because if we use the strong sense, then we can't get to the weak one. But if we use the weak one, we can. We can get to the strong one. The strong one would be written P or Q, but not both. So that would, in logic, that would look like this. Little wedges is or, P or Q, but not both P and Q. So we can write that strong, I thought you had access to the board, my fault. P or Q, but not both, can be written using the weak sense of or, P or Q, maybe both, but not both P and Q. We can write this as the strong sense as the weak. So we use the weak symbol for or in the weak sense, because then we can write strong sense. But if you start at meaning the strong sense, there's no way to get the weak sense. So those are certain relationships. And his last type is modality. A statement can be, in Aristotelian logic, problematic or assertoric or apodictic. Now, aren't those words we use every day? Probably not. But here's what Aristotle meant. Problematic meant a thing is possibly true, but we don't know whether it is or not for sure. And that can be a statement can be like that, right? Well, maybe not. Problematic is the name he gives to it. Then he talked about assertoric. This means a statement that is asserted, that asserts that something is the case, and it is the case. It's assertoric if it's true. And finally, apodictic is a term we don't use anymore at all, but it means for certain, for sure. Here's a statement that for sure, okay. And it may be for sure because it's a law, like one and one is two, or things equal to the same thing are equal to each other, or it could be a tautology. Everything's either visible or it's not. Everything either smells bad or it doesn't. But that's for sure. Can't fail to be false. Now, what Kant wants to say here about this stuff is that it shows that each of these types of statements is possible because there's a certain kind of concept that's possible. Listen to Kant in his own words here. All knowledge demands a concept, though that concept may be quite imperfect or obscure. But a concept is always, as regards to its form, something universal that serves as a rule. Now, what we think of usually is concepts. I mean, in ordinary speech, if we talk about that kind of stuff, is that we abstract properties from something sufficient to identify it for us, or sufficient for us to use it in a certain way. So I have a concept of my travel case, the case I pack my clothes and other stuff in to travel. And I make sure it's got a property that will enable me to distinguish it from all the other travel cases coming down the baggage chute to the airport. Namely, I put a tag on it with my name on the tag. That's one property no other bag is going to have. Unless someone's going to a lot of trouble to make life miserable for me, mine will be the only one with my name on it. But prior to that, I pick it out. It helps me to pick it out because it has certain other properties. Now, mine happens to be green, rough cloth. So I don't look at the red and the black and the yellow cases coming down. I look for the green ones. And some of them are mine, and one of them is mine, some of them are not. That's what we usually think of concept. What we do is, in a concept, we combine the properties of the object of which we have the concept into a thought unity. That's what a concept is. It puts these things together. But for individual things, it never puts all its properties together. Our concepts of individual things are always incomplete, and that's understood by everybody. So it's easy for me to get confused, say, if somebody does try to play a trick, puts a case on the airport belt that looks just like mine, it's made of the same material, the same color, and then they put on a tag with my name and address. And now I'm going to get fooled. I'm going to pick this thing up and walk away with it, and it won't be my case. Because I'm not including in my concept every property that this has. Now, if it included every property, it would have to include what's inside the case. Because it's really a property of the case that it contains the following objects. And mine doesn't contain gold bars, and it doesn't contain drugs that are going to be sold on the market. But if that's what's up, if somebody's put stolen goods in mine in order to get it through in some way, I don't know how it helps them put it in mine, but then I've got a case that looks just like mine from the outside because I didn't include my concept what's inside. I include that. I know what I put in the case. So I include what's inside the case. And when I open it up, if I find a gold bar or heroin, I'm going to say somebody's playing a trick. They're trying to get something passed in my case. So a complete concept of an individual would be every property it has and everything that it relates to in any way, relational properties included, see. So our concepts of individuals are always partial. But our concepts of classes of things are normally complete. So if someone says all crows are black, if it's true that there are no albino crows, then that statement is true. If we show some genetic reason why they can't be any other color, then we know it's true. So we can have a class concept and include in it all the properties that are true of that type of thing and all the properties, and it's only those properties that apply. And sorry for my hesitation, but it's all and only. Okay, if I can distinguish trees or suitcases or cars or crows by making a concept of the class of them, then that can be a complete concept. Because I put into that concept all the properties that make this thing what it is. So it's all of that kind of thing. All crows have this property, and only crows are things that all have that property. So it has to be more than just black, right? We need all the defining characteristics of a bird, and then just black, and then other characteristics as well to distinguish it from blackbirds or other birds with other names that are also black. All right, look, so he wants types of concepts, and what I just read to you, which is why I got off on that sidetrack, how we make concepts. He says a concept always serves as a rule. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is a real daring kind of hypothesis. Okay. What he's trying to tell you is that we have rules in our minds for what counts as a this, a that, or the other. And we have all, our minds have already organized this set of colors, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds, organized spatially, organized temporally, and to be, let's say, a vase with a flower in it. That was the example I was using before. I'll stick with it. It's a vase with a flower in it. Now, say, wait a minute. We experience the vase with the flower in it. We abstract the properties and put them together, and that's how we know this is a vase, because that's how we get the concept of a vase, and we put into it the properties that the vase has, and it has all the necessary and sufficient properties to be a vase. And Kant says, oh, but first, your mind has imposed that order on this set of sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds that are somewhere in some shape at some time. The concept isn't just what we form when we abstract from it, he says. It's a rule that turns our percepts into this form. Oh, you get this. He doesn't deny that we experience vases and abstract the properties that are needed for us to identify the vase or use the vase or whatever. No, we do that. But first, we have unconsciously imposed on what was already there, which was only sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds, plus space, plus time, the form and shape and utility of a vase. And all the other properties that it needs to have to be one. You can get flowers into it, for example. If I show you something that looks pretty much like a vase and you look over the top of it and it's got a solid top covering, you can't put anything in it, it's not a vase. So Kant's adding to, not subtracting from. He's not doing what Hume mostly did. You think you know this, ha ha, you don't, that's gone. You think you know that, oh yeah, what's the impression from it that idea is derived? Can't tell me then, that's gone too. But constantly, he says, no, unconsciously, the mind's doing a lot of work that you're not aware of. And the first two things is it's imposing space and it's imposing time. And the next thing is it's imposing concepts. Or what become concepts after we experience it, we form a concept of it, but we're forming a concept of what? The concept of a vase already imposed on all this stuff that made it, it turned it into that thing that you experienced. That's a big jump. So there are types of concepts that correspond to the types of judgments. If we can make statements of that are in this form, it's because that's what how we can express what we know. Well then, under quantity, he puts, we have a concept of unifying things, we have a concept of grasping plurality of things, and he's going to have correspondences all along here, and I will get you that list in a second. But he is going to say there are corresponding types of concepts to every type of judgment, and that's how it's possible to make those judgments. So, sorry about that. I had some notes that I used, and they fell on the floor, so it didn't record me groveling and getting my notes. I want to tell you about the kinds of concepts that correspond to these types of statements that we were looking at, and I want you to hear Kant in his own words about what's going on there. The concept, he has already said, is a type of rule. And unity, plurality, and totality is one kind of them. So prior to our experiencing anything, the concept is a rule for organizing the space, time, sensory stuff, the data that's given and organized by space and time. And it does this by imposing other properties on it, because it's a rule or a law for what counts as a vase. That's our example. Listen to what Kant says. Just as appearances don't exist in themselves, but only relative to the subject, insofar as it has senses, sight, taste, touch, smell, and sound, so too the laws do not exist in the appearances, in the objects, but only relative to this same being insofar as he has understanding of it. So a concept is two things. He's not denying that after we experience something, we can form a concept of it consciously, keep that concept in mind, and apply it to things. So somebody says, would you please hand me the vase off the shelf? I don't go get the book. My experience organizes the sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds that are temporal, spatial, such that it forms a vase. And have already done that unconsciously. In other words, the only thing we get out of our conscious experience is stuff our minds have already put into it unconsciously prior to our experience or without our experience. We're unconscious of all this going on. And the only thing that actually comes to us and is given are the sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds. And they are chaotic. And that's how all this is going to work. So I think there's some serious problems with this, but we'll talk about them after I finish this list for you. What are the quality concepts? Well, he thinks these correspond to reality, negation, denying something, asserting it so, denying it so, and limitation. There are concepts for each. So I have a concept that such and such is real. I can have a concept that is not. There's no vase on that shelf. I can't hand you one because there's none there. Or some kind of limitation. He might say, hand me all 10 of the vases that are on that shelf. And I might say, I'm sorry, Charlie, but there's only 3. He may be disappointed, but too bad. There are also concepts of relation, and this is really important. One kind is inherence in a substance. Now, I would have thought Kant might get rid of this idea of substance. I find so objectionable. But he thinks that regarding things as inhering in other things and requiring them, depending on them for their existence, is obviously a concept we could have, or we wouldn't have statements to correspond to it. And every other philosopher is talking about substance. And people in ordinary everyday experience and dealing with life think of things that way anyhow. The walls of this room are brown, but brown isn't a substance. It doesn't exist on its own. So it depends on the wood, it's the color of the wood. So we're going to allow it, inherence in the substance. And we're going to have other things as well. For example, causality. And in this, he gets cause and effect. So this is a really big one for science, right? Hume thought he got rid of it all. Do you ever see anything called causality? What color is it? What sound does it make? Is it sweet or sour, or hot or cold? And you don't have any idea. Kant says, oh yeah, we have ideas of lots of things in art, sight, taste, touches, smells, and sounds. We have ideas of all these things because the mind is pre-programmed to organize its experience this way, and it imposes cause and effect on relations. Not all relations, but on some. And there's also reciprocity. The way two things can interact and inter-affect one another. Neither produces the other, but they produce effects in each other. So he's saying inherence, reciprocity, and cause and effect. And now all of science is going to come back. Now Newton isn't a collection of ridiculous statements that have no basis in fact or can't fit into your theory of knowledge. And that's where Hume left things. And finally, there's the modality. And the modality means, in the case of concepts, it's probability, possibility, or impossibility. It means its existence, or its non-existence. And it means that it's necessary, and this can have a number of senses, it's necessary or it's contingent. So we view things as possible and impossible in the number of senses. Necessary and contingent in a number of senses. Think of that list of kinds of properties and laws that I put on that board in the previous lecture. There's quantitative possibility and impossibility, right? We could say that something is, well, it's possible there's more than 10 of them, or it's not possible that there's more than 200, something like that. We can assert the existence or non-existence of something. In fact, we're doing theory of reality now so that Kant can say whether we're doing theory of knowledge now so Kant can say whether or not we can get a theory of reality. He wants to establish what the mind can do and what it can't do, all for the purpose of getting a theory of reality, if that's possible. All right. And then some things aren't necessary or contingent. Well, we already know several senses in which that's true. Things can be quantitative necessarily, logically necessary, physically necessary. There are biotic necessities of life. It's necessary. You have to have this or you die. And then things that are not necessary, we call contingent. That just means they don't have to be. So if this vase is blue, that's interesting. It may be true, but it's not necessary. A thing doesn't have to be blue to be a vase. But it's a contingent truth, in fact, that it is blue. Remember, Hume called all them matters of fact. Okay, so Kant built this for us now. he's going to pack into the mind and have it contribute all the elements that in addition to the bare sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds that come to it. I have a lot of problems with a good bit of this, and I want to pause and say what they are right now, rather than cover a great deal more and then have to have you have to remember further back. Let's start with this arrangement we had, and the one that I made the chart for you. Thinking of the mind as maybe a house, and this is the blueprint. And what comes to the house is chaotic, sensory, and sensory, and that's what's fed in. You remember. I have a real problem there. Maybe you do too. If space exists only in minds, and it's a way that minds organize their sensations, how can we talk about the sensation, the chaotic sensory manifold, he calls it? How can that be outside our minds and come in? That's spatial. That assumes there's space that our minds are in, as well as space true of the things that are in the mind. And anyway, isn't that problematic about what's in the mind and what isn't? Aren't you still thinking of the mind as a space, distinguished from another space, so that what's in the mind is distinct from what's outside the mind? There can't be inside and outside to the mind, right? That doesn't make any sense, because space and time are forms of the sensory intuition. They impose themselves on these chaotic sensory things and form it maybe into a vase. But we're using all this spatial language to say how this happens. And space is supposed to exist, be true only of the objects it has been imposed on by our minds. But he's making use of inside, outside the mind that comes to them. And anyway, isn't he then also doing this with causality? That's supposed to be one of the categories, logical categories of the understanding. Right? Causality. That's imposed on this seen object, experienced object also. But how can you make sense of this so far unless the chaotic sense data that are just given to our experience are the cause of this image that we experience? The account seems to just assume, well, the chaotic sense data come and from outside, when there can't be outside, and they come in and they cause this. No, causality is imposed on it by us. If causality is just something imposed on things by us, how those things get to be things in our experience, in order for causality to be imposed on them, can't be explained by causation. Nothing can be the cause of that image on which causality is imposed. It relates to other things causally. If I drop it, it breaks. Well, it caused that. Door tipped the vase off the table and it fell on the cement floor and crashed into 1,000 pieces. That's a causal explanation of why that vase is scattered all over the floor now. But you can't say that about how the vase gets to be experienced in the first place if causality is one of the categories of the understanding the mind imposes on its sense data. what it sensorily experiences, any more than there can be outside and inside. And I have other troubles with this. What's outside is supposed to be chaotic. Here Kant says, somewhat convincingly, if what we're talking about here are just pure sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds, they do not occur in time, they do not occur in space. Subtract time and space, subtract all the categories of the understanding, such as reality and negation and causality and the rest. Then, ladies and gentlemen, I don't see how such a chaos can be sensory. In my book, sensory is a genuine kind of properties that things have. And there are laws that hold among sensory properties. Nothing can appear both blue and red at the same time to the same person. That's a law. And I think there are other ones. And there are laws that concern feelings, not just perceptual data, but Kant and the others all included feelings in this too. And we know that feelings can occur in syndromes and their patterns and so forth that psychology makes great use of. But how can something be a specific type of property, kind of property, if it's totally chaotic, if there's no kind of order at all to these things that come into the mind, then there can't be the order, say, of the spectrum. Red, right? It goes, how can there be red, orange, yellow, green? Indigo, violet, right? That's an order. Oh, sorry, I thought you were seeing that. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. That's the order that we see these colors when we shine light through a prism. It's the order in a rainbow. But that's an order. That's something that's orderly. And these things, whatever they are supposed to lack all order. They're chaotic. But if in a genuine total chaos, you shouldn't be able to distinguish red from green, from blue, from anything. Or hot from cold, sweet from sour, loud, soft. Because that much is order. And if it's total chaos, it can't even be sensory. So I find great difficulties with this scheme. Clever is the devil, but man, if this is chaotic, it can't also be sensory. If this is what comes in the mind and is formed into this, isn't this the cause of that? Sometimes it seems to me Kant almost sees this himself and tries to fudge it. He says, well, one thing gives rise to another. Well, what's that mean? That sounds to me like just a cover up for causes. One thing causes another. And if the category of causality is only imposed on this once it's inside the mind, this can't be the cause, but if it's not, what is? Why do these things occur in our minds? The the objections that come to my mind are all of the same form. There, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't tell me that all this stuff gets to be true of what we experience. I mean, all the space and time and all the categories. And that's the finished product in our minds, and that's what we're conscious of with all this stuff true of it that our minds previously imposed upon it, because our concepts are not only what we abstract from things, there are rules already in our mind that made that thing what it is. And then blithely talk about causality and space and time as though they already exist in a real world outside of us, independent of us, as perceivers. So it's not that this is unproblematic. I mean, he's fixated on refuting Hume. And step by step, that's what he's doing here. And his big clever move is whatever isn't a sight, taste, touch, smell, sound is imposed by the mind itself. But I don't see how he can explain it if he takes away causality from this end of the picture. I'm sorry. Takes causality away from here and claims it's only imposed by categories. And if he has to envision all this as happening simultaneously, but that means you can't say the imposition of space and time occurs instantaneously or before or after anything. And yet he wants the categories, the concepts, as rules, right? Concepts, there are two kinds. The concepts that we form of a thing after we experience it by abstracting its defining characteristics and others that we need to know in order to use the thing the way we wish. We form a concept. But a concept as a rule for what it is to be a vase has already been imposed on all this stuff. But how do we explain that without using already and before our experience, you know? We talk as though the time's already there. In fact, Kant even at one point raises this issue, and he raises it this way. How can the pure categories of the understanding, pure means purely logical, that's his term for it, how can the purely logical categories of the understanding be applied to the purely sensory forms of the intuition? So he's walled reality off also, the same way all the other guys in this period did. Doesn't matter, from Descartes on, everybody worried about mind and matter, the purely material and the purely logical or sensory. How can they interact? How can they be combined? They're utterly different. What's a purely sensory property? I've already said it umpteen times. Sight, taste, touch, smell, sound. Then how can the purely logical categories, and what they're the ones on that list I gave you, the reality, negation, limitation, unity, plurality, combined things, some things are relational, they are inherent, others are causal. Here are all these concepts. They exist as rules prior to our experiencing the thing that their influence helps produce. How can that not be a causal relation? Aren't those concepts that are unconscious to us when they impose themselves upon the perception we're going to experience or we are experiencing, don't they cause that object to to have the properties they're imposing? And you can't say yes because causality is one of them, one of the things that's being imposed. How can purely logical categories of the understanding be imposed on what's purely sensory? And here's Kant's answer. He says it's possible because time is already schematized, arranged by the categories. How can the purely sensory apply to the purely logical and vice versa? Well, because time's already organized by the categories. That's why you can measure time and so on. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what is called in logic begging the question. Begging the question doesn't mean, you know, I've said something provocative that leads you to ask a question. In logic, it means you argue in a circle. So if I were to say to someone, God exists, and they say, how do you know that? And I offered the following proof. The Bible says God exists. The Bible was inspired by God. God can't lie, therefore God exists. Is that a good argument? Of course not. Why? Because the premises are supposed to show that the conclusion is true. Right? But God inspired the Bible already assumes God exists. So I can't derive the existence of God from using a premise that already assumes the existence of God. That is true only if the existence of God is true. That's to argue in a circle. Premise is supposed to show the conclusion is true. You can't use the conclusion in the premise and have a valid inference. And that's what Kant did here, sorry to say. Giving that answer, he can't say time, I'll write it here, is already organized. His term is schematized. By the categories. That begs the question, as an answer to how can the purely logical apply to the purely sensory. Kant never acknowledged that or took it back, but it is interesting that in his third book, he raises the question again and gives a different answer. He says that there's a mediating something that allows these two pure things to affect one another. And he calls that the imagination, and he goes on with his theory. So I think he realized, whoops, that doesn't fly. I'll just raise the issue again and give another, hopefully better answer. We're certainly not going to get to Kant's third book in this undergraduate introductory course. He wrote three great critiques, and the Critique of Pure Reason is what we're looking at. It's his theory of knowledge that tells us whether or not we can get a theory of reality. The Critique of Pure Judgment, in which he's talking about ethics and how we can know ethical truths, and the Critique of Pure Judgment, which has to do with aesthetics, beauty. Why do we regard some things as works of art and others are not, and so on, and how can we get that, account for that experience? And then he wrote some smaller works also about ethics, in addition to the second critique. We are going to do Kant's ethics for sure. That's a given. So we have a very bold scheme, an architecture of the mind and how it works, but I didn't finish it. We're not complete here yet. Let's get it back up on the board. Here's the chaotic sensory. Manifold just means a whole lot of stuff. And it's what comes through here and is organized by space and time. These are the forms of sensory intuition. In other words, perception. And this chaotic manifold is organized spatially and temporally. And I'll put our vase back up here. But not only spatially and temporally, but also by the categories of the understanding. That is, if we're going to understand what we experience, it can't just be space and time that's imposed on it. It has to be some sort of logical, that is, conceptual order. And there are many kinds of this, and we went through the list, and these are also imposed on here. So it ends up with measurable quantity, qualities that can be distinguished. It can enter into relations that are relations of dependent things to the substance in which they adhere, or cause and effect, or reciprocity. They can act back and forth with other things and affect them. And all that stuff is imposed here. But we didn't get to the last one. See, there's another set of ideas that gets imposed, and we need to account for these. And these he calls ideas of reason. Sometimes pure reason. Reinen Vernunft. Pure reason. I don't think there's such a thing, but anyway, he has in these ideas of the reason. And he gives more than one list in different places, but there's nothing serious about that. We can just say he expanded the list or something. It's not that he gives the first list as the only ones that can be that. There are others that can be as well. But here are the main ones that go into this. The self. We have an idea of self. Hume said we didn't, because we couldn't name the sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds that made up the self. Kant says, no, it's one of these ideas of the reason. Now, ideas of the reason are ideas that any rational person will sooner or later think of. They'll occur to them. They will talk using the terms that designate these ideas, that refer to these ideas, have these as their meaning. Everybody talks about their self, themselves, as differentiated from other people and everything else. And that's an idea that occurs to us. Can we give a proof of the self and explain its nature? No. Ideas of the reason can't have that done to them. It's just that being rational, you think this idea. But the only things that can be proved are what the concepts apply to. So concepts apply only to the experience objects that those concepts as rules have already helped to form. And that's where most of the mistakes come in philosophy, Kant says. People spend tons of paper and gallons of ink trying to prove what can't be proven because it's an idea of the reason, not something we can have a concept of. And he distinguishes between ideas and concepts. Sometimes the ideas are called limiting ideas. And I think this is a real contribution to philosophy. I think he's right that there is a difference between them and the sometimes we just have an idea of something. In a concept, we grasp the parts, the properties and parts of the thing, and how the parts and properties are arranged, and we get enough of an idea of that to be able to use or identify whatever it is we want to want this form a concept of this thing for. Varies very much. It's my suitcase coming down the airport turnstile. I want to get that, but I don't use my suitcase to write a check. Then I need a pen, and there's a definition of a pen. Its parts and properties are combined a certain way by the concept, and that's how I know it. That's how I have understanding. It's how I make inferences about those things, because I have concepts of them. So those are the conscious concepts we form, right? And they correspond, then, if they're correct, to the unconscious, the concepts as rules that made this thing what it is in the first place. But trying to imply the logical concepts to the ideas of the reason just produces confusion. And to back that up, Kant offers us a proof that space is infinite, and another proof that space is not infinite. And he insists both have true premises and perfectly valid inference. And that should show us that that's not the kind of thing logic applies to. And that's how he defends that point. He does the same thing with time. What else? There's the self. There is the idea of things in themselves. That is an external world. That idea arises in everybody, God says. Hume had recognized that. Remember the clever thing Hume said, "I give you my proof there are no, we can't know the world outside of ourselves, and I know that 10 minutes later you'll go right back into believing there's a real external world." Well, he's right. And Kant's handling of that same issue is to say that we have an idea that there's a world in itself, independent of us, and we normally think that our perceptions are just like that world, and our perceptions show us what that world is like. But that's an idea of the reason. Can we prove that our perceptions are what the world is really like? No. He says no. Can we prove there are things in themselves? No. But we all have that idea, and we all need it to get through life. We function this way. And there's another idea of the reason. The most real being. You know, this is the idea of where does this all come from anyway? But that's not the part he emphasizes. Kant's going to emphasize God, or the idea of God, as the idea not so much of as creator of the world. You see, here's the world we experience. And who is creating that? Well, chaotic sensory stuff comes in, and then our minds create everything else about it. So he doesn't regard God as the creator of the world. God is the moral judge. A little weird, huh? God's not the creator, but he is a morally perfect person who will stand in judgment on all of us on the judgment day. And he says, we know this because we have a natural belief, we'll cover this in detail in the ethics, we have a natural belief that there ought to be a correspondence between doing good and some kind of reward, and doing evil and some kind of punishment. We think that those things go together. There's a real moral order to our world, to our experience, and therefore to us. That's part of what we read into our experience. We organize it more consciously rather than being unconsciously imposed by having the idea of self and things in a real world external to us and God are brought in to help organize that experience. Overall, big picture stuff, the whole of life, the whole of reality. We can't think about it without distinguishing things from ourselves and our, and in his theory, the self that's adding everything to what was purely sensory chaos, adding everything in order to make it not a chaos but an organized experience that we can analyze, talk about, live in, do, make use of, and so on. We need the categories of the understanding for that too. We also need the ideas of the reason. They help us organize experience more consciously than unconsciously. They help us think about arranging our lives and what they mean, what purpose, to what purpose we work and live, and so on. Now, other times he gives some other examples too of ideas of the reason. He includes some other things. And one of the other things is freedom. Real freedom. And Kant's big on this. He wants to be the champion of free will and free thought. It's a pity this problem is always termed, spoken of, in terms of free will, though it only means choices. But humans have to be free not only in the choices they make, if they're to be morally responsible for them, but they need to be uncoerced, uncompelled in their reasoning if they're ever to come to any conclusion for reasons. If it's to be a rational conclusion drawn, they agonize over what's the truth, investigate, weigh evidence, look at counter evidence, construct deductive arguments, survey inductively, and so on. Go through all of this, they come to some conclusion. It's not always all that complicated. It can be, where's the mistake on my adding up the checkbook? And there are, just go over it and find an arithmetical mistake or something. But I've come to that conclusion for a reason. I found the mistake in the numbers. Reasoning has to be free also if there's to be anything called knowledge. Because knowledge means you're certain of it. And you're certain of it either because you can produce other reasons why it is true, or because it's self-evident. I've given examples of that as well. Self-evidency of 1 and 1 is 2. The self-evidency of nothing can be both true and false at the same time in the same sense. Okay. These are ideas of the reason. They cannot be proven true. They cannot be proven false. He wants to deny both things. They are imposed on our experience. They arise in our experience, not because they're derived from sense perceptions, but because sense perception is the occasion for thinking about them. And Kant would add, you can't live without them. These have what he calls practical value. Now, when we come to look at philosophy, we're going to take a brief survey of philosophy after Kant, 19th century, 20th century. We're going to see that these things, these ways that he's divided up knowledge, come to be in those centuries starting points for other philosophical movements. So there are going to be people that are going to insist that it, either you know something by sensory perception or you don't know it, except for logic. and they were called positivists in the late 19th, 20th century. Positivists, something is known by sight, taste, touch, smell, sound, and we impose logic on it consciously, and that's what we reason about, and that can explain the whole of our experience. And there are people that took another tack and said, not so. What we come to believe and our the meanings of our terms and all the rest of that, all of this is set for us by what's practically useful. These are people in largely in the 20th century who want to give up altogether on the idea of truth. What's wrong with this entire period, they say, this modern period that you and I are looking at now? What's wrong with this is that people think that there's some utter truth that can be gotten to, and they're looking for what's indubitable, what's certain, what's for sure. And they're right, yes, these people were. That's what they were looking for. And they were trying to account for how knowledge works and what reality is like in the light of looking for certain truths that you could rely on. And that trend is the one that trades off of this business here with the ideas of the reason. Kant saying the ideas can't be proven true or false, that's not what we should look for, but they're useful, and we should concern ourselves with how we use them. And that movement in the 20th century was called pragmatism. And pragmatism does not mean be a practical person. It's not a piece of homey advice. It means we give up on truth. People, there are, say in mathematics, conflicts about what are supposed to be self-evident axioms. And there are different schools of thought that have different axioms. And none of them ever convinces the other that the one that they hold, right? They just butt heads century after century. And they don't agree on how to do it. It's not that they come out with the same conclusions anyway. They don't. What counts as a proof to the intuitionists is less than what counts to a proof by a logicist or something else, other position. So some accept this, here, this is a proof. And, oh no, I don't accept that rule. But you didn't get a proof of that. So their differences are serious. And there are differences of opinion about the logical axioms as well. So it's not that that's apodictic certainty. Strange old-timey term for complete certainty. Apodictic. Kant says it. We could wish for it. But I'm sorry, Charlie, we don't have it. But the idea that ideas of reason, what reason comes up with, a self, a most real and perfect moral being who will judges ethically, and a world in itself, are things we can't escape. We can't help but thinking of them, and you can't really live according to them. I mean, that was what Hume's point was, wasn't it? I know that 10 minutes after I show you we can't know there's an external world, you'll go right back into treating the world as though it is the external world. That's right. And Kant wants to agree with that. And that's because it's an idea of the reason. It's valuable. It helps us organize our lives. And I started to say the idea of God does this because God is the moral judge. Our natural idea of morality, this is what I started to tell you, is that when we do good, we should benefit. There should be at least the approval of other people that you did well. When we do evil, there should be some kind of corresponding punishment. But it doesn't always work that way, does it? The good often suffer. Evil people are often rewarded. There's a whole book of the Bible, Job. It's dedicated to that. It's called The Problem of Evil. Kant doesn't have that because God isn't making the world around us. It's sensations in our minds. Our minds are making the world we experience. But we still do think there should be a correspondence between doing good and at least not suffering and some kind of benefit, and evil, which should result in some kind of suffering. And that doesn't play out that way in this world. Therefore, we come up with the idea of a perfect moral judge who will make it turn out that way in the next world. The way to put this is, for him, God is a, he calls it, postulate. It's a theory. God's a hypothesis of our moral reasoning. We can know moral rules. We can have ethics. Ethical right and wrong are not in this category of ideas of the reason that can't be proven or disproven. Ethics can be. We can show why things are right and wrong and how to tell the difference. But we know that their right isn't always properly rewarded and evil isn't always properly punished in this world. So we make a hypothesis, a guess, that that'll be straightened out in another life by moral being, perfectly moral being we name God. And that's what he means by God. Well, we'll stop with these ideas of the reason. Our time's up, and we'll tackle a summary comparison, and we'll go to Kant's ethics. So, do the reading, I keep saying. Review the recordings, and I'll see you next time.